the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised. Okay.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Yeah. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Oh, once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, 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 Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, 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 Nicole.
What do you think?
Just
I love it.
That
was great. Thank you.
After yesterday.
Somebody
laughs.
Excuse me.
Big laughs out in the hall.
After yesterday, I thought that was the appropriate way to begin today. Welcome to it. It's a Tuesday, although I know it kind of feels like a Monday. I'm Nicole Sandler, and I apologize for yesterday. I had every intention of doing a show, but I got sidetracked dealing with the what I call government sanctioned extortion, which is my name for our health insurance system in this country. And I call it a health insurance system because it's certainly not a health care system. It's health insurance. And it is government sanctioned extortion because you have to pay for it. You have to have it. If you don't have it, well, then they'll break you. And if you do have it, they'll break you in other ways. Yeah. So here's what happened. Long story short. I wasn't sick yesterday, but I was here. I was ready to do a show. However, I've been dealing with with an insurance issue that came to a head yesterday just as I was going on the air. So I had spent the hour leading up to now, leading up to 5 p.m. Eastern yesterday, fighting with people and crying. Because that's what it came to. So here's it's a long story, but those of you who've listened for a while know that I have dealt with restless leg syndrome for years. I mean, I'm talking 30 years now. This thing, I first realized, knew what it was in 1997. At the time, I was co-hosting the morning show on 91X in San Diego. And I was having a particularly bad bout of what I later learned was restless leg syndrome. It's a sensation that like you have ants crawling inside your legs. And basically you got to get up and move. You cannot be seated. You cannot be lying down. You have the sensation that makes you get up and move. Standing and walking is the only thing that settles it down. Obviously, it doesn't lend to sleep. Right? Sleeping is almost impossible. And so back in 1997, I came in, I was tired, I was bitchy. And my co-host, Chris Cantori, said, "What's up with you today?" And I said, "It's weird. I have this thing. I don't know what it is," and I described the sensation and the phone started ringing. And people said, "It's a thing. It's called restless leg syndrome." And sure enough, I look it up and there it is. So I had already been suffering through it for years. The problem is there's really no cure. They treat it these days with Parkinson's medications, except so when those medications came out, it's got to be 10 years ago already. There's something called Requip and there's another one called Mirapex. And the side effects from them were bad. So I, you know, one of them, they make me nauseous and super tired. So the thing is with those, you have to take them before the effects begin, which is usually at night. So if I took the pills, you know, 6-7 o'clock before the symptoms kick in, by 8 o'clock, one, I'd be feeling nauseous, and two, I couldn't keep my eyes open. But I decided, let me try to go back on them because it's been probably 10 years since I've been on those. And in the meantime, I've been using these patches. And I've had a fight every year with the insurance company about the patches, but they finally did a thing where they authorize it because I've tried everything else. So my neurologist, and this comes through a neurologist, I had to change neurologists because she no longer takes my insurance. So I switched neurologists just around the time that my prescription ran out. Obviously, that's why I needed the new neurologist. So I go see her. We decide we're going to take me off of the patches and we're going to try some other things. Well, long story, even longer story, shorter, didn't work. So not only didn't it work, it got worse. So I've been going through this for a month. So I called the doctor 2 weeks ago, or I sent her a note and I said, the Requip is making me nauseous again. Now I know why I didn't take it. Can't do it. Got to go back on the patches. But my prescription had run out. So she called in a new prescription. Well, I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and they never filled the prescription. So I finally called the pharmacy Thursday. This is Thursday of last week, and said, what's up with this prescription? And she said, oh, it's not covered by your insurance. I said, well, look through my records. You'll see it has been for years. Oh, well, the authorization ran out. And I'm like, was anybody going to bother telling me this? So I have to call the doctor's office. And I went back and forth for days. That was Thursday. Finally, yesterday, still nothing was done. And so I realized the person who does the prescriptions and the authorizations and whatever at the doctor's office, the only way to get her to get on the goddamn phone was to say, I want to talk to the office manager. Then she came to the phone. So spoke to her finally. Then it still wasn't done. And this, I'm going back and forth with them all day yesterday. Finally, the doctor called me. I'm like, this is ridiculous already. I can't sleep. You know, what's the problem? So by the time, and this was literally when I hung up with her, it was probably 10 minutes to 5. I had a show planned. Digby was going to be here. I was ready to go. But I had been crying, been fighting with these people. And what I realized is the only way, you know, you have to stay on top of everything because nobody does their job. And I said to them, so the only way this is going to get done is if I personally call the insurance company, keep the rep from the insurance company on the line with me while I get someone from the doctor's office on the line with me so you people can talk. What do I pay you for? So anyway, it all got settled, go figure. And the patches just arrived. So anyway, that's what that is. Gary Null, old Sage Joe, is a quack. Vitamin D does nothing for restless leg syndrome. As somebody who suffered through it for 30 years, I promise you, vitamin D does nothing. Iron allegedly helps. Nothing helps me. It sucks. It sucks. I will fall asleep standing up. That's how bad it is. So anyway, that's done. But this happened after a weekend. So I told you a couple of weeks ago about the leak in the wall. Well, then this weekend, our air conditioning died. I'm telling you, it is one thing after another, after another, after another. So when I hear I'm at my wit's end, every now and then I lose it. So that's what that is. I see in the chat room a little bit of talk about some of the paintings behind me. There's a new batch on the wall. And yes, Winston Smith said, those are my cats. And sure enough, if you can see them, well, I can't show you. It's the two cats. Let's see if I can zoom in on them. I know it's not very good radio for those of you listening, but... you know, I could use the income. So I'm just about finished with this batch. Winston Smith, I figured I'd show you here live on the show. And so these are Winston Smith's two kitties. And I'm not even going to try to tell you their names. And, oh, I got stuff in the way, so you really can't see them well. But beautiful cats. And I think the picture came out well. I got stuff blocking it. And then over here are two others. I'm going in the wrong direction. So let's see if I can, I'm trying to show you the pictures. And there's the two other kitties. these are two and one. These two go together. So anyway, I'm just about done with these paintings that I was working on. So Winston Smith, I will send you photos to make sure you're cool with them. And I will ship them out, hopefully tomorrow, fully insured, by the way. And the other ones will go out, too. Those are I'm drawing a blank on who the person is, but I know he's not in the chat room. Anyway, I'm open for business. So if you're interested in having a pet portrait done, perfect holiday gift, everybody. Do just, you know, send me an email, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com, and we'll talk. Okay, so before we get to today's guest, and boy, it's a good one, and I'll explain in a moment. Yesterday, you know, I thought at least, you know, it's a day without Facebook. What could possibly go wrong? Well, somebody from Facebook, you know, the people from Facebook are trying to do damage control. You know, it doesn't always work, but they try. And so we have a guest on who is a Facebook spokesperson. If I can get the video working, here we go. All right, so let's see. Let's check in with her. I think her name is like Blair or something. Is that your name, Blair? What's up over there at Facebook?
Thank you for having me. Yes, we here at Facebook would just like to say, I thought you deleted Facebook. We just think it's kind of funny that last night everybody was like hashtag delete Facebook. And then this morning they're like hashtag Facebook down. You know, because like, which one is it? Did y'all already delete it or is it down? Because it can't be down if you delete it. You know what I mean? Are we supposed to apologize for paying attention to you and knowing what you're doing and where you are and what you like? Because we are listening to you constantly. Because guess who else is listening to you? Nobody. We're the only ones, okay? Everybody wants to bring up Tom from MySpace. Tom's our best friend. Tom left you.
Oh.
Okay? Do you think Tom thinks about you now? He doesn't. He's a photographer now. Okay, Tom. And I guess the last thing that we'd like to say is good luck remembering your mom's birthday now, you pieces of shit.
Blair Erskine, who now takes on the persona of a Facebook apologist. So I figured that was more entertaining than the hearings today, although the hearings are kind of entertaining. Anyway, so I wanted to do something. We're moving on now. Hope you enjoyed that. She's hysterical. It is Blair Erskine. She's just so damn funny. All right. So the debt ceiling is ridiculous. And so I was looking for someone to explain what's going on. And of course, I automatically go for my go-to person on economics, and that's Stephanie Kelton, author of The Deficit Myth, expert on modern monetary theory. And so I texted her last night or yes, whatever it was. And she's like, I'm on the road, so I wouldn't be able to do it until next Monday. She said, but you should talk to Rowan Gray. And it turns out Rowan Gray actually wrote the bill with Rashida Tlaib's office that she introduced last year to mint $2 trillion platinum coins as a way to not extend or suspend the debt ceiling, but in order to give every person in this country $2,000 and then an additional $1,000 monthly until we got past the COVID mess. Obviously, that didn't happen. But Rohan Gray has been talking about minting a coin for a long, long time. And so he's going to join us in a few minutes. But before we get there, I want to share with you an op-ed that ran in the Washington Post just a few days ago, written by Zachary Carter, who you may recall was our guest last week. When was Zach on? He was here on Wednesday of last week, talking about economics, right? And Keynesian economics. So anyway, the headline of this op-ed in the Washington Post reads, "The debt ceiling is an absurd problem. Only an absurd solution can save us." And here's what he wrote. "For the third time in a decade, the U.S. government is threatening to blow up the global financial system. There is no economic rationale for this threat, and its consummation promises no political advantage to anyone. It is a preposterous, silly, and breathtakingly dangerous situation. Fortunately, it can be resolved with a preposterous, silly, and perfectly painless legal trick, minting a single platinum coin with a face value of $1 trillion or more. The ongoing Senate debate over the federal debt ceiling embodies everything comical and grotesque about modern American political dysfunction. Unless Congress or the Treasury Department acts, the U.S. government will default on its debt by October 18th. Because U.S. Treasury bonds are a basic unit of international finance, a default would immediately throw global investment into chaos. Treasuries are formally deemed risk-free by bankers and bank regulators. They serve as an official benchmark of reliability for all other lending and investing, public or private, and are used as collateral for loans all over the world. A default would force an immediate revaluation of a wide range of matters, including money market funds and the geopolitical status of China and the European Union. According to the number crunchers at Moody's, a U.S. government debt default would destroy 6 million American jobs and send the domestic unemployment rate to 9%. But even this valiant effort to quantify the potential damage understates the risk. It's simply impossible to predict how major investors and other governments would respond to the shock of a previously inconceivable event. We don't really know how severe or prolonged the damage could be. The worst part, though, is that if there is a default, it will not be because the government can't afford to pay its bills or failed to market its bonds. We are instead the improbable captives of a technicality established during World War I, an era when the Bank of England called the tune for the global economy and money was denominated in different weights of gold. Until 1917, the U.S. government typically issued debt at the specific direction of Congress. A law was passed every time the government wanted to raise money from investors, a situation that proved inconvenient to the exigencies of 20th century warfare. So Congress simplified its legislative calendar by deputizing the Treasury Department to take care of whatever borrowing might be required to meet the war spending Congress had approved. A formal limit on the amount of debt Treasury could sell was imposed to prevent bureaucrats from running wild with their new responsibilities. Got this so far? All right, it gets better. Zach Carter does a great job of explaining the history of the debt ceiling and the ridiculousness of it. Continues. So the debt ceiling was not designed to be an important instrument of economic policy. Congress retained the power to set all spending in tax terms as it does today. But Congress also must vote every now and then to raise the limit on Treasury's authority to borrow. Failing to do so means the government can't meet the obligations it has already approved. Here's the good part. A decade ago, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell decided to turn what had always been a routine process, ensuring that the government paid its bondholders, into a political weapon. In 2011, the GOP wanted to force President Barack Obama to accept a slate of conservative legislative demands. The party would vote to raise the debt ceiling, but only if Obama agreed to cut a bunch of spending programs for the poor. Publicly, Republicans pitched this high-stakes hostage-taking as an act of fiscal responsibility. America had too much debt, they insisted, and Republicans weren't going to stand for it. Of course, America kept accumulating debt after Obama, and the Republicans eventually cut a deal, and it kept on accumulating debt after they made another debt ceiling deal in 2013, and more debt after then-President Orange Guy cut taxes in 2017, and even more after he spent trillions on coronavirus relief in 2020. One essential lesson that economists have learned from the past decade is that the supposed dangers of a large national debt have been vastly overstated. None of this debt caused a financial crisis, fueled hyperinflation, or prevented us from responding to a major international health crisis, as the doomsayers had argued. The chief danger posed by the debt today lies in the possibility that the United States might just default for fun. This time around, Senate Republicans aren't even pretending to pursue a policy goal. They're not demanding concessions to conservative agenda items in other areas in exchange for their support. They think voting to raise the debt ceiling will be unpopular, and they hope to deploy the vote in attack ads targeting Democrats next year. McConnell tacitly acknowledges that the whole thing is a media stunt, insisting that the government will not, in fact, default, even if the actions of his caucus make default more likely. Asked this past week why he thinks Democrats will find a way to raise the debt ceiling without Republican votes in a 50-50 Senate, McConnell replied, "Because we always do." Until we don't. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer actually likes the politics of universal Republican opposition. He wants to brand the GOP as the party of default. But he contends that the formal process for holding a debt ceiling vote cannot be completed before the default deadline without Republican support. This is why House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler wants the Biden administration to mint a platinum coin. Mint the coin! Sorry. Under an obscure provision of a federal appropriations law passed in 1996, the president can authorize the Treasury to mint platinum coins at any face value it chooses. Sorry, gold bugs, the coin really does have to be platinum. The Treasury could mint, say, a $1 trillion coin, deposit it at the Federal Reserve, and then use the funds to pay the government's obligations without incurring additional debt, obviating the need to borrow any more money for as long as the Biden administration would like, just as if it had a trillion $1 bills on deposit in a bank. And no, you don't need to lose any sleep over the prospect of the coin being stolen. Nobody could accept it for payment. Imagine making change for $1 trillion. And anyway, the Treasury could always mint another one. This was something of a joke when it was first popularized by a lawyer named Carlos Mucha during the 2011 debt ceiling standoff. It was a clever, silly, and extremely efficient solution to a very dangerous problem, but not many people thought it would actually happen. Here we are, a decade later, during yet another artificial debt limit crisis, and it seems like an idea whose time has come. The key to this process is that it is economically meaningless. It doesn't authorize additional spending. It simply allows Treasury to fulfill the fiscal orders Congress has already placed. The value of the coin could be $1 trillion, $100 trillion, or $250 billion. And it would have the same effect on the day-to-day workings of the economy. Strange as it is to consider, minting a coin with a ridiculous number of zeros is the most responsible way for President Biden to resolve this situation. Congress could functionally eliminate the debt ceiling by holding a vote to raise the limit to, say, $1 quadrillion. But the political and practical hurdles for that vote would remain, and a $1 quadrillion coin would be just as good. Zach Carter wraps this up by writing, "The debt ceiling was never designed to be a weapon of destruction. Legislators should not have the power to threaten global financial calamity in pursuit of increasingly petty partisan aims. With a platinum coin or two on account at the Fed, the debt ceiling could be rendered meaningless indefinitely, eliminating a wholly artificial and unnecessary source of crisis. Silly problems demand silly solutions." Again, it's so brilliantly written, right? That was Zachary D. Carter writing in the Washington Post an op-ed. This was published on the 1st. So when was that? Friday. That was published on Friday by Zach Carter after he was on the show Wednesday and we talked about that. So I'm just going to bring you in, Rohan, because now I see you. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened there, but thank you so much for joining us today.
No worries.
Thank you for joining me. Rohan Gray, you are an assistant professor of law at Willamette Law?
Yes. Willamette. I'm being told it's Willamette, damn it, Janet.
So Willamette. In Portland, right? You're in the Portland area.
It's in Salem, but yeah.
Okay, right. There you go. Oregon, easier that way. You're also president of the Modern Money Network. It's on Twitter at the MMT Network. And people can also find more about you at your website, Rohan Gray, ROHANGREY.net. And Rohan, earlier this week or last week, when we're talking about this whole debt ceiling mess, I knew I wanted to do a segment on it. And I'm not great on things dealing with the economy, but I figured, let me call my old friend, a regular guest on the show, Stephanie Kelton, because she can explain this stuff to me. And so I messaged her and she wrote back. She's like, I'm on the road. I wouldn't be able to do anything until next week at the earliest. She said, you know who you should talk to is Rohan Gray. And then I started reading her Twitter thread and she referenced an interview that you did, I believe, with somebody at Bloomberg Business Week about the coin. And as it turns out, the more I read about you, the more interesting you became. You actually, let's back up about a year, because there was a legislation introduced in the House by Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. You actually worked with her office to write that bill, and it was to coin a $1 trillion platinum coin. But it didn't have anything to do with the debt ceiling. Why don't you tell us what this was about?
Yeah, this was the Automatic Boost to Communities Act, and shout out to Congresswoman Tlaib and to Congresswoman Jayapal in their offices, and to Chasti Murphy in particular, who was the lead in Congresswoman Tlaib's office on that issue. Apologies, there's some sound outside.
I didn't know if it was noise on the line or outside. Okay,
no, it's outside. Apologies.
Got it. No worries.
Anyway, and that was during the height of the COVID pandemic. And Congressman Tlaib was actually one of the first, if not, I think, the first to propose recurring relief checks of $2,000 a month for everybody and another $1,000 for another year after the crisis to deal with the immense pain that people were feeling. And when we were designing that bill, we had a couple of different design constraints, because the basic idea of, you know, get cash to everybody as much as possible to help them, you know, make it through is pretty basic. But when you're dealing with, for example, people who don't have bank accounts, and people who may be undocumented, and people who may not, you know, have access to tax returns, things like that, it becomes logistically a lot more difficult. So we had to think about the method of delivery, how to get it into people's hands, how not to turn it into a surveillance tool for marginalized and vulnerable populations. And one of the things we were looking at is how can we design a financing mechanism so that this doesn't become something that, you know, Republicans and others put attack ads out there saying, look, we're bankrupt with the country, you know, we can't afford this. And thinking back to 2009, when the stimulus package happened, there was immediately this backlash and the bipartisan deficit reduction commission and President Obama saying, we've run out of money now. And all of this stuff just overtook the real suffering that people were experiencing in the public imagination. And what we wanted to do was to try to arrest that kind of hysteria before it gets off the ground, and to say, look, we're at a time now when the president stood up in the presidential debates and said, you know, we out of Treasury will pay for this. You know, there's nothing that this pandemic, you know, we're not going to have a situation where we can't afford to deal with this pandemic. We had people like Neel Kashkari, the president of the Minneapolis Fed, saying the Fed has infinite dollars to deal with this crisis. So saying the big infinity word that we normally don't like to talk about when it comes to how much money we have.
Right.
It's a far cry from President Obama saying we're out of money now in his 60 Minutes interview. And it was building on the public understanding around this mint the coin going back to the debt ceiling debates in 2011. So unlike the current, you know, proposal, which is to use the existing law on the books, this would have been new legislation explicitly directing the Treasury Secretary to mint the coin. So even critics of the coin now who say, you know, it's pushing the law past its intent and those kinds of things, were forced to acknowledge that the coin in that context would have been completely 100,000%, you know, incontrovertibly legal, because Congress is directly telling the president to use the coinage power for that purpose.
Right.
And people like Paul Krugman and others said, yeah, look, you know, my only objection to this is I don't think we need it, because, you know, it doesn't do anything that regular financing via issuing treasury debt doesn't already do. It's exactly the same economically. It's no more inflationary, et cetera. To which, of course, my answer was, well, the difference is that we don't misunderstand what's going on and think that we're borrowing from our grandchildren and that, you know, we're adding to the credit card. And the symbolism is the point. Substantively, it is pretty much the same. But symbolically, it would have been a huge sea change if we had had this conversation about where money comes from at the height of that pandemic. And maybe right now we wouldn't be negotiating $3.5 trillion down to $1.5 trillion.
Right.
Maybe we'd be up closer to the $6 trillion that you know, Senator Sanders and others think that we need to to prevent the heat death of the planet.
Well, you're sounding like a modern monetary theory expert proponent, which you are, right? So if
guilty
you,
as charged,
if yeah. you don't mind, because you know we're progressive, you know, leaning. Not all Democrats, but you know we're progressive thinkers over here, not necessarily great economists. As I say way too often, the one thing I'm good at when it comes to money is spending it. Not really good with anything else, but I try, and that's why I'm always you know asking Stephanie Kelton questions. So now I get to ask you questions. Let's back up a little bit and try to bring this down to really simple terms that I can understand, because I know one of the tenets of modern monetary theory is we have the money. That's not a question. And we are capable, you know, the United States is the treasury. You can make the money. We can print it, basically. So when we talk about the debt ceiling is the limit of how much the U.S. government can borrow. Who are we borrowing from? I keep hearing, you know, Republicans and fearmongers saying, you know, we're our future is mortgaged to China. Our kids are going to be paying China for their life. What's the truth? Who are we borrowing money from and why?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is that money and debt, government debt, are actually a lot closer to each other than the average person thinks. So you and I, when we borrow, we're doing that when we don't have money. Right. So we're doing it when the cash in our account, you know, runs out, or when we want to keep it there and not use it, we borrow. And that means that someone else has to provide the money. But when you're the currency issuer, when you're the one that creates the money, then what government debt is in that moment is another form of money. And I know that sounds counterintuitive. So just bear with me for a second.
Okay.
Because
all right.
when the government issues debt, it's issuing a piece of paper or a blip on a computer screen in an account that says, I promise to pay you a certain amount of money on demand, right? You take $100 of treasury debt on the day that it matures into the bank and you say, hey, I'd like to redeem this. They give you five $20 bills.
Right.
You take a $100 bill in today and say, hey, I'd like to redeem this. What were they going to give you? Five $20 bills.
Right.
So right. The $100 of treasury debt, we think of debt as the absence of money. But from the government's point of view, it's issuing instruments into the economy all the time. We're not cranking out a mint in our basement. We're not cranking out a printing press. We don't have a computer where we mark up other people's numbers like we're the guy who runs the bowling alley when you score a strike. You know, I'll just put 10 points in because the points are made up. It comes from nowhere. The government is issuing treasury debt in a way that investors hold it as money. So if you speak to Goldman Sachs, and I have had friends who worked in their treasury department who do manage their cash flows, and I say, where do you hold most of your money? Do you hold it in a bank account like me? They said, no, of course not. I said, why not? And they said, because bank accounts are only guaranteed up to $250,000 by the federal government. So if I've got $255,000, or if I'm Goldman Sachs and I've got $10 billion in my cash account, you know, moving money around every day to make sure all our bills get paid and everything. If I've got $10 billion in my bank account, then if that bank goes under, I'm in a lot of trouble.
Okay.
But if I have $10 billion in treasury bills, in three-month treasury debt, then if I need to sell that for cash, I can sell that instantly because there's an incredibly deep market of people who are buying and selling trillions of dollars of treasury bills every day. And even if all of them stopped, even if they all called in sick one day to the trading markets, the Federal Reserve is there at the back end as the final buyer saying, we will buy up as many as we need to keep interest rates where we want them to be.
Okay.
So there's never a situation where you've got treasury bills and you don't want them, but you can't sell them to somebody.
Right.
Just like if you've got money in your saving account, even if you can't spend it directly at a vending machine or at a coffee shop, you can just move it into your checking account and then spend it. Sure. Nowadays, we can spend directly from our saving account. But for a long period of time, you would have to move it around.
Right.
So having your money in treasury debt is like having it in large denominations. It's like, hey, we've got $20 bill, $50 bill, $100 bill. But if you're dealing with millions or tens of millions or billions, you're probably storing those dollars in treasury.
Okay.
Securities.
So and it's not really a loan then.
No, it's an asset.
Okay.
It's an asset for them.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and when you issue the treasury debt, you swap it for other cash instruments, just like if I had a $100 bill, and I wanted to issue it into the economy. But the first thing I wanted to buy was a can of soda at a vending machine. So I say to somebody, here, I'll give you a $100 bill. You give me $98 in singles, and then I can go spend it at the vending machine.
Right.
So there are people out there, Social Security recipients, government employees, who don't want to be receiving paychecks in treasury bills and treasury bonds.
Right.
They want to receive it in money in their account. So we sell the treasury bonds to the investors. They give us the smaller denomination monies that they have access to, and then we spend that out. So, yes, if you think about it as borrowing something we don't already have, then it sounds very bad. If you think about it as issuing an instrument that is an obligation of the government, just like coins are, just like notes are, then it's just a different form of money. Now, typically, historically, one of the differences was that it earned interest. Uh-huh. But nowadays, we pay interest on reserves held at the Fed. So that difference is not a real difference anymore. Things that we would think of as, oh, it earns zero interest, and that's the difference. Treasury bonds earn 5%, your checking account earns nothing.
Right.
That's not a difference anymore. And the other big difference was that when we were under a gold standard, if the government made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of Federal Reserve notes and somebody took them to the Federal Reserve Bank and said, I'd like gold, they were legally obligated to convert it into gold. And that meant that if you run out of gold, you might be in a problem.
Right.
But since we got off the gold standard, which we got off domestically in 1935 and internationally in 1973, as I said at the very, very beginning, if you come in with a $100 bill and you ask for change, they do not give you a lump of gold. They give you other sure. pieces of paper,
right.
other dollars. So right. that's all that both a treasury bill and a Federal Reserve note is
okay.
promising.
Okay, so with the debt ceiling, and I don't know what the number is, but they need to raise it. Is that saying you can't issue more treasury bills than this amount rather than you
yes.
can't borrow money? What? So
that's exactly right. Think about it as a limit on issuing a kind of instrument. So imagine I said, hey, you know, you play Monopoly and at the start you get a certain amount of dollars, right? Well, you get one $500 note,
right.
then you get a couple of hundreds, then you get a couple of
right. 50.
So imagine I said, nobody can issue, you know, you can't get more than two $500 bills. Okay. Does that mean I can't get the rest of my money? No, I just get them in hundreds.
Right.
I get them in
sure.
I get them in something else. So if you have a debt ceiling limit, that's a limit on issuing one kind of instrument. But if there's other instruments that you can issue, then that debt ceiling limit isn't a limit on spending. It isn't a limit on actually doing anything. It's only a limit on one kind of instrument. And in fact, we have other limits today. There is a limit that is a leftover from the Civil War when they used to issue greenbacks directly from the Treasury. They looked like Federal Reserve notes.
Uh-huh.
But at the top, they said issued by the Treasury,
uh-huh.
not issued by the Federal Reserve. And they don't count towards the debt limit because they're cash.
Hmm.
They're just dollars that circulate. And we have a ceiling on that, which was $300 million. It's still on the books today. We just stopped issuing them because they became obsolete when Federal Reserve notes did the job better. But that is a ceiling. That is exactly the same kind of ceiling. There's a $300 million ceiling on that. There's a $19 trillion ceiling on the debt limit. If you're the Tennessee Valley Authority, you have your own independent legal authority to issue debt, but there's a $30 billion limit on that.
Okay,
and
so it's not really debt then that they're talking about, right? It's
a limit on high denominational digital money.
Okay.
And there's other forms of money we can issue so that if Congress says you must spend, You are legally required as the president, as the Treasury, we told you to spend. Congress has the power to tell how much to spend, and your job is to execute it. If we tell you to spend a certain amount and not issue more Treasury debt to finance it, then the obvious answer is issue something else that you are allowed to issue.
Okay. But so we are not borrowing money from China that our grandchildren are going to have to pay back at some point.
No, we're giving China a savings account instead of a checking account. That's
got it. Okay. So this whole thing, it sounds like the economics reporters need an education, and so does Congress, because they're positioning it all wrong. So
that's right.
Basically, they're saying. And the whole thing about the debt ceiling, you know, I just read a piece while we were waiting for you that was in the Washington Post on Friday.
Zach Carter's piece.
Zach was actually on the show last Wednesday, and he wrote this piece, which explains it beautifully. It's a preposterous, silly, and breathtakingly dangerous situation, and it's a preposterous, silly, and perfectly painless legal trick to fix it. Mount the single platinum coin with a face value of $1 trillion or more. That way, whatever they're saying, this is your limit of how many bonds you can issue. Well, there's plenty of money in there to back it up, so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, and the real limit, the real constraint, the real thing we should be debating is the budget itself.
Yeah.
If we don't want to spend on military spending or tax cuts to the rich or whatever, we should debate that in the budget. But once the budget is passed, once Congress has sent that message out, you know, Paul Revere's out on the road in his horse, racing all the way to, you know, the president's house, and they say, you must spend this amount. For the president to say, I don't want to. There are tools available at my disposal to do it, but I don't want to do it. That is a separation of powers crisis. That is the power grab of the executive branch to say, I would rather shut down the government than spend using this instrument because I think this instrument is silly. I don't like looking silly. So I'm going to make you all not just look silly, but hurt. I'm going to put you out of work. I'm going to make your Social Security check not go through because I don't want to look silly.
Right. But the other part of it,
unacceptable.
The other part of it, though, is I look at it this way, that the debt ceiling, this is money that's already been allocated and approved by Congress. Congress said, we're going to spend this amount of money on these programs and these necessities. We already legislated it. We passed the bill. The president signed it. It's law. We said we're going to spend this money. And so why is the debt ceiling, why does it even exist? Because if I go out and charge something on my credit card, when I sign my name, that's basically me saying I'm going to pay the bill when it comes due. Why isn't that just built into the law that when they spend the money, they'll pay it?
It's a great question. And actually, and this is something that's been lost, but the historical origins of the debt ceiling itself were not to constrain the executive branch, but to give it more discretion. So originally, before 1917, before the very first kind of debt ceiling that came into existence, every time Congress told the executive branch, whether it's the Treasury or the Department of State or wherever else, to spend money, they would pass a financing bill, usually together or right after the spending bill, to say, in order to fund that spending commitment, you have to issue a certain amount of 30-year bonds or a certain amount of 3-month bonds or bills or raise this tax or enact this customs, you know, levy or whatever it is. And then World War I comes along and it's too unwieldy to have 100 different, you know, to use your credit card analogy, it's like having 100 different bank accounts for different spending purposes. And someone says, let's just wrap it all up into one. And if you've got a little bit left over in this one, you can put it over wherever you need to without coming back to me for, you know, every month for additional authority because there's too much going on. So the original debt ceiling was actually designed to make it easier for the Treasury to honor all the spending commitments, not make it harder, not to create another loophole, another tripwire, but actually to take all these different balkanized spending financing powers and just consolidate them. And since then, we've basically raised it as a matter of course, increasingly politicized. It's become an increasing political football. But over the last 7 or 8 years, for example, it's been suspended every year. So what happens is we think of the debt ceiling as in existence. It's been dead letter for 2 years minus one day. And then at the last day, we have this huge fight about it. It comes back into force and then we suspend it again. And then it's suspended again for another 2 years. So it's like if I said I'm on a diet, but on January 1, I suspend my diet. Mm-hmm. And then on January 31st, I impose it again and then suspend it on January 1 again. And then everybody's wondering when I say, actually, you know what? We should give up on this diet. It's silly. And everyone goes, but it's keeping you healthy. Well, no, it's not. It isn't actually providing any limitation. The limitation comes with what I choose to put in my mouth.
Right.
It comes with the budget process. If we think we're spending too much on the wrong things, fix the budget, not do this thing where we impose these obligations and then don't spend them, especially when that's never been the point of the debt. That's never been its original goal. That's a perversion of its original intent to actually make it easier for the Treasury to use whatever tools at their disposal. So in that sense, the coin is a sort of logical extension of why we created the first debt ceiling, to make it easier and easier for the Treasury Secretary to do whatever they think is necessary to honor what Congress tells them to do.
Right. So it seems like this is the easiest way around this. This solves the problem.
You don't need Congress involved.
Mitch McConnell out of the whole equation, right? Because
it cuts the Democratic senators who are refusing to change the filibuster as well.
Yeah.
Because at this point, we need 60 votes or we need to kill the filibuster. And there's no way in hell we're getting 60 votes. And there's no way that half of these Democrats want to get rid of the filibuster.
Right. Now, a bit of, I guess, breaking news from, this morning. Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, this is Jeff Stein of Washington Post tweeting this. Yellen torches platinum coin. I don't think we should be considering it seriously. It's really a gimmick. It comprises the independence of the Fed, compromises the independence of the Fed. And instead of showing Congress and the administration can be trusted to pay the country's bills, it does the opposite. How does it do the opposite? If it's all
it's very ironic because it's literally paying the bills.
Right.
The alternative is to default. This is literally a thing to ensure the bills get paid. And the irony, of course, is, first of all, we return hundreds of millions of dollars in coin revenue signage every year to the Treasury. I've never heard anybody get a check from the government and ask whether that money came from coins or came from somewhere else.
Right.
Nobody cares. The check is the check. So once the money is coming back out again, nobody's going to say, oh, I was owed money and you paid me money, but it came from the wrong place, so I don't want it. That's crazy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is this idea that it violates Federal Reserve independence is not true. The Federal Reserve will retain all the power it needs to set interest rates. It has $7 trillion of Treasury securities on its balance sheet already. So if it wanted to, it could simply sell some of those into the circulation. And it would be the same as if the Treasury had issued them in the first place. It's just not adding to the overall number.
Right.
But the effect would be it takes on the coin and then the Treasury securities go out into the economy. So the effect would be, from everybody else's perspective, the government, the Treasury and the Fed together issued Treasury securities out into circulation. It's just in this situation, it would come from the ones that the Fed already has on hand rather than newly issued ones from the Treasury. And then the Fed would just simply hold the coin instead, right? The Treasury securities sit there on its balance sheet. You just substitute them out. The coin sits there. Everything looks exactly the same. But to her point about it being a gimmick, she's right. It is a gimmick. But it is a gimmick in the way that all accounting is a gimmick. When the first really nasty debt ceiling fight happened in 85, the Treasury Secretary at the time actually raided the Social Security Trust Funds. And they did a legal analysis afterwards, the Government Accountability Office. And they said, look, this was probably illegal. But given the extraordinary circumstances, we're going to give them a pass. We think it's understandable that they did this. So it's not unusual to use gimmicks when you're dealing with a gimmicky problem.
Right.
And it's not unusual to use extraordinary tools when you're dealing with extraordinary circumstances. The challenge here, of course, is that I think that the Biden administration wants to force the Republicans to come to the negotiating table. And so if there's another option on the table that they can do themselves, then that takes the pressure off the Republicans. So they don't want to take this seriously, not because it can't be taken seriously, but because it doesn't suit their political strategy here, which is to basically put a gun to the head of the American economy and say, if you don't come back to the negotiating table, Republicans, we'll pull the trigger. We will let this go over a cliff and it will be your fault because you didn't come and negotiate with us.
Right.
And for the record, but I got no love for the Republicans. I think they're being completely nihilistic here. But the idea that the Democrats should be gambling with the whole economy to win this partisan fight is its own form of power grab, form of cynical politics.
Right. Why do you think the Democrats are not, you know, the only way they can do it right now is through reconciliation. And what I understand,
because they don't want to sound stupid. They don't want to sound silly. They want to sound serious. And they don't want to give any impression that it's their fault if something bad happens. They want the Republicans to own whatever negative comes out of this. And well, I think that's not their right to do. It's not true. They left things on the table they could have done to avoid that outcome.
The Democrats did. The thing is, though, this is to pay for the spending that is already done. It's not to pay for any future spending or even what they're talking about now, right?
But do we really think we're going to get any more spending if we can't even fund the existing? So, you know, this is going to be just a hard stop on the President Biden's entire agenda.
Right. So, but if I understand correctly, their problem with going through reconciliation is, one, the time frame. It takes at least 2 weeks, and we're less than 2 weeks away from the hard end, right? So they needed to do this starting last week. The other part is they don't want the Voterama, which comes with it, so that the Republicans can introduce,
attack ads and everything.
Just amendment after amendment after amendment, and they can delay it and delay it to force us into default. And the thing is, the American public, I hate to say it, is just so uninformed that they don't understand that this is Mitch McConnell threatening to tank the good faith and credit of the U.S. government for the first time ever.
Yeah. And if the Democrats were serious about playing hardball, they would say what Mitch McConnell is doing is stupid and destructive, and we're not going to let it hurt the American people. So we are going to use whatever tools we have to prevent that default. That doesn't mean we like using them. That doesn't mean we think it's the best way to do things. But if the alternative is catastrophic default, you can be damn sure we're not going to let Mitch McConnell torpedo the economy. But they're not doing that. They're saying, gee, it'd be really bad if he did this.
Yeah.
We really hope he'll come back to the negotiating table. And I've said before, you know, it must be the last institutional norm in D.C. that anybody really believes is going to be respected. The idea that the Republicans are going to come vote for this. And even if they do this time, look how much worse it is this time compared to last time.
Oh, yeah. Well,
how much worse it was last time compared to the time before.
But the last time, but for the 4 years that Trump was in office, the Democrats said, sure, we'll go. He raised the debt ceiling. We'll suspend it for a year and we'll suspend it for another year without any any negotiation. Yeah. So there,
the time to play hardball and demand the debt ceiling gets canceled or gets just completely eliminated
now,
was when Trump was in office. We're not going to raise it. You need to get rid of it. But they didn't. And now Mitch McConnell has once again outplayed them. And they are leaving the tools on the table that could outplay him again.
This is so, you know, I always say I wish we could take the politics out of politics. Because this is exactly what I'm talking about. Mitch McConnell is guilty of governmental malpractice. I mean, what he's doing is really reprehensible, but everything that party does is reprehensible. And I'm not saying the Democrats are blameless because they're flat out stupid. You know,
right? At a certain point, if somebody is, you know, incapable of not lighting fire to things and you invite them into a barn house full of dry hay, that's on you, right? Who is responsible at this point for hoping that the Republicans will play a sane game? The Democrats. So, yeah, I have no love for what the Republicans are doing. I think it's absolutely nihilistic. But the only people in the room who are dumb enough to put the power in their hands is the Democrats. And they shouldn't do it. The president has the power to end this with the stroke of a pen and get back to real issues.
Wow. So now if you all of a sudden, Rowan Gray, they bring you into Congress and say, save us. We so fucked things up. What do we do to turn it around? You would tell them to mint the coin? What would you tell them to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a bunch of other things. But yeah, in terms of the debt ceiling crisis, I would tell the president to mint a coin, to not make a big deal about it, and to get it into the Federal Reserve and demand the Federal Reserve accept it, and to credit the account. And then a few days later to tell the people, yeah, we've done this and it's worked. Nothing, you know, that the roof didn't collapse, et cetera. And, you know, stuff would come out in the meantime, but average people are barely even paying attention to the rest of this stuff. And as you said, if you try to explain what's going on in DC right now to anybody, it sounds like the plot of a bad movie. It's so unrealistic. Someone would say, this is too on the nose. This is not, you know, this is not convincingly real. And so this just feeds into all of that. It's not like someone go, well, I thought this whole process was really sane and really sensible, but then they minted a coin, so now it's all crazy. The whole process is already a farce.
Yeah.
And if it's already a farce, let's just get out of it and move back to stuff that actually matters.
How do we re-educate the nation that we're not in debt, we're not putting our children and grandchildren in debt to China for their future?
Well, I think this is where the coin has a secondary value. In the immediate short sense, it gets us out of this crisis moment. It takes that gun away from the head of the American economy. and allows this to be described for what it is, which is a stupid accounting fight by mm-hmm. cynical politicians with each other,
right.
playing a game between themselves where it just happens to be holding the whole economy hostage. But the other pedagogical value is it becomes very, very hard to entertain and to keep entertaining these myths about how money works when you've just minted a trillion-dollar coin. So sometimes, just like it takes an orange clown becoming president for people to realize just how, you know, fragile our democratic institutions are, it may take a big symbolic act to force a reset of the whole discussion. And it wouldn't just be America. The whole world would be brought into a big collective reimagining of what money is if this happened. And we're doing it to a weird extent already. For the last decade, we've been doing things like quantitative easing mm-hmm. and direct purchases of assets. Right now, the Bank of Japan owns sort of half of the Japanese stock market.
Really?
It's buying up more treasury debt every month than the Treasury of Japan is issuing.
And hasn't our treasury been propping up the
yeah,
market?
And that wasn't a cause of inflation. We have some inflation now from bottlenecks in mm-hmm. certain industries for the pandemic, but we want the act of sort of issuing more dollars and less dollar treasury debt into the economy didn't magically suddenly inflate anything. Because as I said, it's the difference between putting money in your checking account or your savings account. You're not magically richer when it goes into one account.
Just moving it around.
Yeah. And so, you know, but the problem is that it's all super complicated. QE, what is quantitative easing? Even the term makes your eyes glaze over unless you've got a macroeconomics degree. Right. So there's bond auctions, and then there's these things called primary dealers who buy the bonds and then they sell it to the Fed. What does all this mean? But minting a coin, it's simple.
Yes.
It captures the imagination. It's something you can tell a five-year-old. And that has the power to take this debate, which is right now happening amongst finance people and economists and policymakers, and bring it down to the level of average people. And yes, it's going to break a few brains along the way, and then they're going to mend. And then they're going to be healthier on the other side.
If you had to predict what's going to happen, what would you think? Knowing our government the way you do, what would you think they're going to do?
I try not to indulge the worst kinds of fantasies about how dumb things could get, because they usually end up superseding even then. But it could be pretty bad.
Yeah,
there could be a default, not necessarily on treasury debt, but other spending commitments, you know, like a super government shutdown, so social security checks don't go out and things like that. You know, I don't think Mitch McConnell wants to piss off the global investor class, but I think if a few, you know, social security beneficiaries didn't get their money and blame Joe Biden, I think he'd be happy about that.
Oh, God. God forbid. I don't even want to think about it. And I can't believe that Joe Biden would let that happen. But if we get to a point where it's too late to do reconciliation and Mitch McConnell won't budge, we're kind of screwed, aren't we?
Unless you mint the coin. And if the only thing standing between minting the coin and default is the desire to look silly or not look silly, you know, well, this is not serious. You know what apparently is serious? A global default.
No shit. I mean, wow.
Why is that the more serious person's response in this?
Wow. Good question. Rowan Gray, thank you for the information. I mean, my head is spinning. It all makes sense. I wish we could just shake some sense into the people in D.C. to say, do something already.
I think we need to just be insistent to not let them define this problem on their own terms, because they will keep saying we're not going to consider the coin. It's not viable. And they're going to drive off a cliff, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be their fault. But we will have let them by taking seriously these claims they make that are just not true.
Wow. Wow. Is there anybody in Congress other than Rashida Tlaib and
Congressman Jerry Nadler, actually.
Jerry Nadler, right.
The head of the House Judiciary Committee.
That's so, right. You know, he's saying it.
Yeah, he's saying it. And there are others, I think, who floated the idea. Congressman Yarmuth, who is the head of the House Budget Committee, raised it as a possible option. And, you know, there were over a dozen co-sponsors of the ABC Act that Congressman Tlaib put out there. So, you know, there are people who are willing to entertain the idea of kind of quote unquote minting high value coins to fund the government. But at this point, I think they're getting a lot of directives from the White House that we want to kind of keep the narrative focused around the idea that there's no option but to force the Republicans to come to the negotiation.
Well, and that's ridiculous.
And I understand it politically. Yeah. I understand the political strategy. I think it's wrong, but it's also dishonest. And I think that dishonesty is ultimately going to be more corrosive to democracy and to good governance, because, you know, we expect the Republicans and the Trumpists to lie. But if the Democrats are doing it as well, then we've got nothing left.
No.
And, you know, I'm not saying I expect them to tell the truth all the time, but we need to be able to hold them accountable when they don't. Surely,
please.
We need to have one party we assume is telling some semblance of the truth.
That would be nice. Rowan Gray, thank you so much. I don't like the way it is, but I appreciate your information so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You take care. Bye-bye. All right, with that, we're done. Such as it is, it's frustrating, right? Oh my goodness. Oh boy. And with that, we come to the end of another show. I'm stunned. I mean, I know that DC is broken, but this just shows they're completely FUBAR. They're just done. And something's got to be done. Honestly, the only way out seems to be the coin. So get on the phone. Call your senators and congressperson. I don't know what else to say. Oh, my goodness. All right, with that, we're done. Tomorrow, joining me on the show is somebody I first spoke to a long time ago. It's got to be at least 10 years ago because it was when Air America was still on the air. And she released a documentary called The Brainwashing of My Dad. And then it went on to wider release. It was actually fully released, I think, just in 2016. And now she's got a book to go with it. Her name is Jen Sanko. Her father was brainwashed by Fox. This, I honestly believe, this is what happened to Donald Trump. Not that he was ever like a normal, thinking, brilliant man or anything, but he wasn't the nut job that he turned into. And I really believe it is a byproduct of his watching Fox, not news. So Jen Sanko joins us tomorrow, and I will leave you with the news. Thanks for hanging, everybody. Don't forget, I am taking your orders for pet portraits, and you too could get a beautiful portrait like these kitties behind me. All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye. Oh, I got to do this.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
As we're weathering a tornado of crises, one is heading our way faster than the others, promising utter destruction if we suffer a direct hit, the debt ceiling. President Biden on Monday increased pressure on Republicans to agree to raise the debt ceiling to pay for spending already approved by Congress. He accused them of being
hypocritical, dangerous, and disgraceful
by risking a devastating federal default.
The meteor is headed to crash into our economy. Democrats are willing to do all the work stopping it. Republicans just have to let us do our job. Just get out of the way. You don't want to help save the country? Get out of the way so you don't destroy it.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the government will run out of ways to keep paying its bills by October 18th. The Republicans, led by Mitch McConnell, have said that Democrats should handle raising the debt ceiling by themselves, something McConnell never had to do when they were in charge because the Democrats didn't play this dangerous game. Just saying. Facebook and its applications, including WhatsApp and Instagram, all went down worldwide on Monday, as did the internal systems used by Facebook's employees. The services were out for about 6 hours. The company saying its engineers found that changes to the internet infrastructure of its servers disrupted network traffic between its data centers. Service was finally restored about 6 hours later. But the timing on the massive outage was interesting. It came the day after a whistleblower, Frances Haugen, told her story about Facebook on 60 Minutes. And the day before she's scheduled to testify in front of a Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection about the monopolistic social media giant. Yes, that testimony happens today, Tuesday. Well, the Biden administration on Monday scrapped a rule imposed by the former guy that barred clinics who provide abortion services from receiving federal family planning funds simply for advising people about abortion. The new rule for the Title X Family Planning Program will authorize these health centers to continue receiving federal money regardless of whether they refer patients to facilities that offer abortions or not. The policy takes effect November 8th. This change came as new abortion laws, including one in Texas, barring people from ending pregnancies after 6 weeks, are giving the Supreme Court's expanded right-wing majority an opportunity to roll back abortion rights guaranteed since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. This one hurts. Dead fish and birds washed ashore in Southern California as cleanup crews rushed to contain an oil spill threatening to keep the shoreline around Huntington Beach closed for months. Officials were looking into suspicions that the leak from an offshore oil pipeline might have been caused by a ship's anchor. Environmentalists expressed outrage and called for an end to offshore drilling. Officials said the spill of more than 125,000 gallons of oil had already damaged wetlands and affected 6 miles of shoreline. Just lovely. Well, the Supreme Court kicked off their new session on Monday, yesterday, and wasted no time. They rejected an offer to give the District of Columbia residents a voting representative in Congress. The justices upheld a lower court ruling against 11 Washington residents who argued that the Constitution gives Congress the power to grant D.C. residents voting representation in the House of Representatives. The gist of their argument being, quote, residents of the District of Columbia are the only adult American citizens subject to federal income taxes who lack voting representation in Congress, except for felons in some states. Well, a three-judge panel rejected that position, citing a decision in an earlier case that found the Constitution says House members should be chosen by, quote, the people of the several states, which leaves out D.C. because it isn't a state. In COVID news, Johnson & Johnson plans to ask the FDA this week to authorize their coronavirus booster shot. Johnson & Johnson is the one-dose vaccine. It'll be the last of the three federally authorized vaccine providers to ask for emergency authorization for a booster vaccine. Stand by. Oh, let the lawsuits begin. A New York State judge on Monday ruled that the former guy must submit to a deposition in a defamation lawsuit filed by a former contestant on the reality TV show The Apprentice. You know, the one that the former guy hosted before he moved into the White House? Yeah. The judge, Justice Jennifer Schechter of the New York State Court in Manhattan, gave Trump until December 23rd to sit for a deposition by the accuser Summer Zervos's lawyers. Zervos accused Trump of unwanted kissing and groping and brought the case after Trump called the allegations of his female accusers lies. Zervos sued Trump in January of 2017. His lawyers blocked the case by arguing that a sitting president couldn't be sued, but he's no longer a sitting president. And finally, members of the Catholic clergy in France sexually abused more than 200,000 minors over the last 7 decades. This according to a landmark report set to be published this afternoon. The numbers are based on estimates from a survey for the commission led by the French National Institute of Health and Medical Research. When including victims of abusers who weren't clergy but had other links to the church, such as Catholic schools and youth programs, the number of possible abuse victims rises to 330,000. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.